Accession number 27083, reel 12.
Sir Henry, I'm sorry. Yes, please continue.
I think it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon of Boxing Day, the 26th, that we got further word through. And I can't remember how that occurred. But it was an indication that Bruce Fraser's estimate was right and that he was making for a Norwegian port. So hope revived. We were all very tired and very cold and pretty hungry and rather seasick too, and so on. But this was just the revival that was needed. And Bruce Fraser's plan, which was promulgated to the entire ship's company, was that, other things being equal, he would plan to close to 12,000 yards, 6 miles, before opening fire. And we had with us a screen of destroyers, and we had the 6-inch cruiser Jamaica. And the Belfast, I think, had the Norfolk with her. I can't remember. It doesn't really matter. And they, of course, were trailing from the north, coming down south with the Scharnhorst. And I think they were able to, from time to time, at any rate, to get off an enemy report that we intercepted, which looked as if all was going all right and we were on an intercept course and so forth. And this is important. And then about, I can't remember the time, I think it was about 5 o'clock in the evening, or so, by which time it was pitch dark. You had, under those conditions, you had about an hour and a half's twilight between midday and nearly 3 in the afternoon, and the rest of the time was dark. And we picked up a contact, and this was the Scharnhorst.
This is a contact on radar?
Yes.
How good, may I interrupt and say, how good was the radar by this time?
Good enough for that. It was quite good. It had been improved enormously from the earlier days.
And so you would see a ship like the Scharnhorst at 30 miles, at 40 miles?
Oh, no. Because of the curvature of the Earth and so forth. More like 20 miles, that sort of thing, miles.
Right.
Anyway, this was a single echo, and it looked like being the Scharnhorst, and it and its movements appeared to fit, and so forth. So we were all standing by, and you can imagine the tenseness and the excitement on board, and you watch the. I was the officer of the turret. I had a sort of a position between the two center guns, and I had a chair there, and I had a periscope. I couldn't see much through the periscope because of all the spray coming in, because of the weather conditions at the time. But I had a range counter, and I had my own little computer in a nearby compartment and so forth, which we had to keep up to date in case you broke down to local control. And you watched the range counters coming down. And then the order came through, all guns with semi-armor piercing and full charge, load. And then came the order, all routine stuff. Noisy while the loading cycle was going on, and then there was deathly hush again. And then all turrets followed director. And so you swung round and followed the director high up on the mast. And thereafter, deathly hush again, except for the squelch of the hydraulics as the trainer and the layers followed their pointers and so forth. And the range counters came ticking down and ticking down and ticking down. And exactly according to plan, when the range came down to 12,000 yards, we opened fire.
Before Scharnhorst?
Oh yes, she hadn't fired a thing yet. And Jamaica had opened fire fractionally sooner with star shell and illuminated the Scharnhorst beautifully. So that you had a visual point of aim as well as just a radar one, which was quite important in those days. And in the light of the star shell, I couldn't from A turret, but those higher up in the ship could, it illuminated the Scharnhorst, and she was caught unawares. Her turrets were trained fore and aft, so.
And you could see that, could you? From where you were?
I personally couldn't.
You couldn't.
But up on the bridge they could. I was too laid down, I was covered in spray.
This is extraordinary that a big ship like the Scharnhorst could sail into a trap with, I mean, it had no radar of its own?
It had perfectly good radar. But, years later, 1970, when I was driving Albion, and we paid a visit to Wilhelmshaven, I think I'll probably come to this later on, suffice to say that I had tea with the sometime executive officer of the Scharnhorst, who was not there at the time of the action, but he had been only a matter of months previously as the executive officer. And he said there was a sort of a thing in the Scharnhorst about operating radar, that they thought it was a bogey. They thought that it gave away more than it acted to your advantage, and they were very reluctant to lose it, to use it. Anyway, there she was, you know, lit up, turrets trained fore and aft, and of course, as soon as she was illuminated, she realized she'd been caught, and she put the wheel over. I don't know whether she went faster. But we then had the awful situation that the range counters, instead of ticking down,
ticked up,
steadied and then picked up. And they ticked up and ticked up and ticked up. Until you know, it was pointless going on firing because you wouldn't have hit anything. And we checked fire. And the despondency was frightful then. And so on. Well, then, I forget how long this went on for, but a finite time. And we thought, oh my God, and after all this, and now she's got away. Suddenly the range counters stopped, steadied, and started to tick down, and tick down, and tick down, and tick down, and they went on ticking down. We ended up, and I forget what the range was, it was something like a couple of miles, if that. And by then she was on fire from end to end. And you could, in the light of the flames, you could see her ship's company leaping over the side to certain death. I mean, it only lasted about 3 minutes in those waters, in any case. And that was that. And the destroyers picked up, I forget the precise number, it was 32, 33, something like that. No officers. which were in due course transferred to us, in due course. And so that was that, and we all felt, very mixed feelings. We felt immense relief that we had carried out a successful action, we'd beaten the enemy, we'd sunk the target, and so forth. And yet somehow we felt a sadness, because there was an obviously very fine ship that we'd killed, and that was that. And because you're that much further apart in action at sea, usually. You have a slight sort of kindred feeling, and she'd fought bravely. She'd done well. Hadn't started off too well, but never mind. And so on. So there was an element of sympathy. And of course, we were very tired. We were very short of sleep. And so we were over emotional, as it were, and so on. And the next thing we knew was that it was worked out that we didn't have enough fuel left to get back to Iceland, even, let alone to Scarpa. And so we had to go on to Russia, which we did. And we entered in due course. We entered in a snowstorm, and we spent, I forget precisely how long, something like 4 days there. In the course of the action, the mainmast had three struts. There was the mast itself, and there were two struts. And one of the struts had been shot through. And that was dangerous. So that had to be repaired, and that was done. And we had some dealings with the Russians, but it was, they tended to be all over us. But they weren't prepared to give us very great credit for this, and they owed none to themselves, and so on. And we left again in a snowstorm 4 days later, and so on. And in due course, returned to Scarpa. By this time, of course, the world knew. And as we entered Scarpa, it was a most moving occasion. And all the ships sort of independently and voluntarily, they got everybody up and they cheered us in.
Can I just ask a few questions on this? Apart from that one hit you've referred to, was the Duke of York hit in any other way at all? In other words, did Scharnhorst land any blows?
No,
or not?
No.
In this entire action, did he manage to hit the Scharnhorst, Duke of York once?
Yeah.
And in the first part of the action, the Duke of York must have hit Scharnhorst many times, because although the range was increasing,
yes,
it must have hit it many times to cause it eventually to stop.
I think so, although during the first part of the action, before we closed right in, and that was the coup de grace, as it were. But prior to that, because the Scharnhorst had altered course away, we were then in the position of following her and trying to catch up. And in the weather conditions of that night, she had the legs of us. She could go faster into those seas than we could. And that was why she drew away, how she drew away. That was one thing. The other thing is that in, I don't want to get too technical, but in gunnery terms, if you are firing more or less over the bow, the slightest movement of the ship in terms of roll will cause a disproportionate error at the end of the shell's trajectory. And it's known as cross-level effect, and you've got various instruments to correct this as far as you can, but it's a bit haphazard. So for all those reasons...
And does the ship being pursued have the same difficulty, firing directly over its stern?
Absolutely,
it does.
Yes.
So both ships were at a disadvantage during the chase?
Yes.
But Duke of York managed to hit Scharnhorst enough to stop it?
Yes, and of course the destroyers carried out a torpedo attack. The main thing was that she was hit. I think this was a 14-inch shell, actually, and this reduced her speed. And once we started to catch up, of course, the end was a foregone conclusion.
Because Duke of York was so much more powerful?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And you were in one of the forward turrets?
I was in the forward foregun, 14-inch turret. Yes.
And I've asked another officer who was on King George V when it used to fire its when it had to operate its guns, whether it was particularly noisy. And he said, no, the noise was outside, not inside the turret.
That's correct. Inside the turret, it was... how do I describe it? It was almost like slamming a door. You didn't wear ear defenders or anything. It wasn't necessary. Outside, it was a different matter altogether, of course.
Yes. So on an open bridge, they would have been deafened every time the guns went off.
Oh, very much so.
Had you had open bridges on, on a ship the size of the Duke of York?
Yes, very much so. And it was deafening. The story goes, and I don't know how true it is, that way back before the war, I think in either Nelson or Rodney, might have been Rodney, not sure, but she was doing usual fleet exercises and stuff, and included in them was to be a 16-inch firing. And some guy from one of the newspapers was on board with his camera, and you know, he had a bear leader to look after him and all that sort of thing. And he was up on the bridge, and he said, well, now, when the guns, before the guns open fire, I want to be down on the forecastle because I want to get a shot of the guns firing. And he was told in fairly cursory terms that there'd be no more him if he attempted that, and so forth. But it wasn't put over very convincingly, or he wouldn't take no for an answer. And they started to fire, and suddenly the bear leader realized that his charge was not there by his side anymore. And they eventually found him. I think they picked him, they checked fire, because they were worried that he fulfilled his intention. And they picked him out of the guardrails on the forecastle, stark naked, unconscious, and black and blue all over. But he survived, miraculously, I think.
So his clothes had been blown off by the concussion?
Stripped clean. Yeah.
Extraordinary. Yes. Yes.
Now, have we got a little bit more?
We have some more time.
Right,
yes,
I'll just finish this off. Then in the autumn of 44...
We're now going back a bit.
No, but a minute, that seems to be a year out. I think I made a cock earlier on, and I think I said that the Scharnhorst action occurred on Boxing Day 44, and I think I was a year out. It would have been 43. So I come now to the next year, and it was the autumn of 44 that Duke of York went down to Liverpool for a refit to prepare her for deployment to the Far East Fleet. And at that point, I left the ship with sadness, because she was a super ship. And I was then appointed as number two to the destroyer Javelin, which was having, I think, her third stern put on in one of the Liverpool docks. And that brings me to my next section.
And you joined the Javelin?
Yes. I joined the Javelin.
What is a number two, Sir Henry?
The captain is the boss. In a destroyer or other small ship, the first lieutenant is the second in command, and the senior lieutenant under the first lieutenant is the number two.
So this is quite speedy promotion for you, isn't it, really? or not?
Not in wartime.
No.
Not in wartime,
okay.
No. Not really. And it's not promotion as such, you know, it's a different experience. You, in those days, did 8 years flat as a lieutenant without the option. And the seniority that you gained in subs courses and exams and so forth was pulled off your sub-lieutenant's term. So you became a lieutenant much earlier and younger and so forth.
But, so, going from being in command of a gun turret to being third in command of a destroyer, that sounds to me like a promotion. An upgrade in responsibilities all round.
Well, I don't know, because in those days a destroyer ship's company numbered 150. In my turret, I had 200, 50 per gun.
Right. Okay.
So, no, it wasn't a promotion, is it?
Okay.
It was a perfectly normal pattern. And then, at some stage around then, or maybe a bit later, I was quite young and early to do that, you either did specialise, sub-specialise, gunnery, navigation, torpedo, whatever, or you did not and remained what was termed assault horse. And I went for gunnery, but I'm coming on to that later.
Yes, yes. So Henry, when you're ready to continue with javelin?
I joined the destroyer javelin in Liverpool in early November 44. She was in dock repairing action damage. I'm not sure she wasn't having her third stern put on. Previous ones having been blown off by torpedoes, I think, in the Mediterranean. The captain was a lieutenant commander, RN, called James Marchbanks, and the first lieutenant was a lieutenant called Peter Bain. My duties as number two, next after the first lieutenant, was cable officer, forecastle divisional officer, and correspondence officer. On joining, my main problem was where to find digs, because the ship's condition was such that you couldn't live on board. And in November, in fact the 18th, as I've already recorded, I had my 21st birthday. Remarkable only for its abject misery, quite honestly. And the best present I was given was by my mother, bless her, who gave me 10 days in the Adelphi Hotel. There, all I saw of it, of course, was breakfast, dinner, and night in a comfortable bed. For dinner, invariably, we had jugged hare. I've never forgotten it, and I never want to see it again. And then eventually, I was desperate to find somewhere, and I found a sort of commercial traveller's lodge, somewhere just off Lime Street. And Lime Street wasn't very salubrious in those days, and even then, the police were at pains to go about in pairs after dark in Lime Street. And this this emporium was run by a Mrs. Hunt, and it was known as Mother Hunt's. And the sitting room, so-called, was divided with sort of sheltered, tiny desks where the commercial travellers worked up their day's work and all that stuff. And supper, which stank of boiled cabbage and overcooked fish, was at 6:30. It was that sort of place. It wasn't much fun. And each day I had to go, can't remember where I joined it, but it was somewhere fairly close to hand, in the overhead railway somewhere along the 20 miles or so of Liverpool docks. And it rained. God, how it rained. Almost incessantly. It was a miserable time. It was a miserable overhead railway. The ship was miserable. Mother Hunt's was miserable. Everything about it was miserable. And I felt miserable too. There was no heating on board because we were on shore supplies and they were limited and so on. I'll skip that because otherwise one can moan on. But gradually the ship's company were drafted and the other officers were appointed and joined. And it was in the spring of 45 that the captain, who, it was his first small ship period, I think, let alone small ship command, and he had been in the old county class cruiser Sussex. Bit by bit, word trickled through that as to what he'd been thought of there. And I don't want to be too disparaging about him. I don't think he's alive now, poor chap. But it was said that in the Sussex, his sobriquet was the Sheep. And this stems from the fact that he had a curious sort of tick that he would half shrug, not his shoulders, but his head, as if his collar was a bit too tight, and he'd turn up his chin and so forth. Anyway, that's a bit of scuttlebutt. Quite rightly, in my view, in the spring of 45, he decided that the amount of work going on in the ship was so minimal that she really wasn't making progress and taking a hell of a time to do it. And so, no doubt he'd contacted higher authority, but he'd expressed the intention, and he was absolutely right to do so, to take the ship away before she'd really finished her refit. And we spent, we undocked, and we spent a terrible night at a berth called Wallace's Stage, which is notorious in Liverpool for the range, the variation in the height of the tide, as much as 30 feet. And the weather was foul, as usual. And in the course of the night, we parted virtually all wires and most of the hurricane hawsers as well. We then left, and we sailed for Scarpa Flow. And as was customary for the destroyers, we berthed in away from the main fleet anchorage in the flow, but over towards Lyoness, where there was a depot ship, and so on. In theory, we were then going to do our workup to efficiency, weld the ship's company together as a team, and so forth. In fact, apart from 3 days or so exercising in filthy weather conditions, gales the whole time, we spent the rest of our, whatever it was, fortnight or so in Scarpa alongside the depot ship, trying to make the ship work. The 3 days we did spend at sea were not a success. It transpired that the captain, under admittedly difficult conditions, but he proved to be a very poor ship handler. I suffered acutely because, being the cable officer, I was stuck on the forecastle with the picking up rope at its full limit, and one spent hours trying to sort of get back under control and not necessarily succeeding. It was a sad time. And then we left and we sailed for the Mediterranean, where the weather would, of course, be better, in order to, I was about to say complete, but you might as well say start our proper workup. And that was fine. And we passed through the Straits of Gibraltar. I don't think we stopped at Gib. We just went straight through. It was the morning watch one day, and I was on watch on the bridge, open bridge again. Lovely, beautiful Mediterranean morning. And we were off Cape Bon, and suddenly there was a loud bang, and the ship stopped. And I thought, oh my God, we've hit a mine. Nothing else in sight at all. So I called the captain and the first lieutenant and so forth. In fact, we had not hit a mine. We had burst a boiler. Not a very usual occurrence, but we'd done it. And we went on, of course, on the other boiler. And we went on to Malta. But the dockyard there was full. And they couldn't take another ship in hand. And so we went on further east to Alexandria. And we berthed alongside a jetty, the other side of which was one of the newer Hunt-class destroyers, the Bicester.